Our special guest lecturer this evening is Rev Shmuel Marcus. Rev Marcus is currently a Magid Shir at Yeshiva University and the Rav of Kehilat Yishei Yisrael in Queens, New York. He is, of course, the son of our late beloved Rav, Harav Rafael Marcus Zatzal, and Yibadel L'chaim, our Rebbetzin Rochalea Marcus, and it's a pleasure to welcome Rebbetzin Marcus, who has joined us this evening. I would also like to welcome Rebbetzin Ox, who has joined us. It's so wonderful that you are here. Thank you. This shir is part of an ongoing midrashah for women in memory of our Rav, whom we so sorely miss. It is sponsored by Mizrahi and by Emunah Women and is supported by the Center for Religious Affairs in the Diaspora of the WZO. Rav Shmuel Marcus is homegrown here in B'nai Torah and in the Torah Jewish community, in the Toronto Jewish community. And he is fondly known by us as Shmuley. Every time he gives a shiur here, we are all delighted by and so proud of his articulate manner and his depth of presentation. And I personally know from a mechutanim in Queens that he has made a wonderful name for himself at YU and in his kehila in New York. And so we here in B'nai Torah also shep nachis, and perhaps even delude ourselves into thinking that we too can take some credit for his continued and growing success, knowing full well that he and his siblings are a true credit to his wonderful parents and are role models for all B'nai Torah in Toronto. We are honored to have Rev Marcus with us tonight and look forward to an enlightening shiur on the topic of Megillat Esther, meaning and message. Rev Marcus.
Thank you so much. First, a word of thanks to the Mizrahi, to Emunah Women, for sponsoring what I hear has been a tremendously successful women's learning program. And I, and I'm sure the rest of my family, are especially grateful that these shiurim are dedicated in memory of my father, Hayinik Paris Mishkavo. And I'm especially thankful to Mrs. B. Rosenfield, to Rabbi Meir Rosenberg, for all of the energy and time they expended to enable me to come here this evening. And as always, it's always a special pleasure to be able to return to B'nai Torah, where I was fortunate to grow up. Formative years were spent here, and I certainly credit this community, this kehila, with imbuing me with the desire to be able to share Divrei Torah with so many others. Often, when we learn Tanakh, so many of the stories are so familiar to us from our preschool, elementary school years, that when we revisit them every so often, at least I personally find it very easy to come away with the same superficial understanding of the story that I had for many years already. And Megillas Esther is certainly no different for me, in that once a year at Purim, we read the Megillah, we're so busy at Purim, we come, we go, so many other things to worry about. It's very hard to often find the time to really sit down and learn through the Megillah in greater depth than before. And tonight, what I'd like to do, with your permission, is to share with you a number of very interesting insights into the Megillah, which are not mine. I'll be taking ideas from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Shlita Rosh Hashiva at Yeshivas Har Etzion, a few ideas from Rav Meir Goldwichter, Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University, and also a theme touched upon by the Malbim and the Vilna Gaon in their opening commentary to the Megillah. And hopefully what I would like to try to accomplish is not just to give us a little added insight into the story of the Megillah, as we all know it, but perhaps to take home a contemporary message that can be applied to our lives today as well. Please feel free throughout the shiur to comment when you would like to. perhaps I'll try to leave some time at the end of this year for additional thoughts or comments as well. Start with the first source on the sheet, which was on the tables. Apologize if there are not enough. It's a famous quote from the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara there says as follows. Amar Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda taught, Shalcha Lahem Esther Lachachamim. Esther sent a message to the Chachamim of her time, and the message was, Kavuni Ledoros. Establish me for all generations. Rashi explains in the very next source, number two, Rashi says, what do you mean, Kavuni, establish me? Rashi says what she meant was, Kavuni li yom tov vilikriya, establish me as an annual celebration, a holiday, and to be read each and every year. Lihiyos li shem, it should be a lasting memory for me. And the Gemara tells us back in source number one that in response to this request, initially the Chachamim were very hesitant. Shalchula, they said back to her, Kina at me'oreres aleinu levein ha'umos, you're going to cause a lot of jealousy against us, a lot of resentment against us by celebrating this victory over the other goyim. And Esther's response was, she was very insistent, and she said, no. Kavar kasuva ani al divrei hayamim l'malchei modei paras. Everyone knows the story already. It's in other history books also. People know what happened. We're not going to teach them anything they don't know. It's for ourselves to remember each and every year, every generation. And the initial question that perhaps might strike you upon reading this Gemara is Esther's choice of words. Kavuni ledoros, establish me for all generations. There seems to be a tremendous emphasis on Esther and Esther alone. Obviously, the Nesa of the Purim Megillah was very wide-ranging. It was an incredible tapestry of godly woven events that had to occur one after another in the right sequence at the right time in the right way to make this Nes fall into place. And certainly Esther was a very critical component of this Nes. But why is the reference to Kavuni, all about me, in Esther's words? And that emphasis again is underscored by the name of the Megillah itself. The name chosen for the Megillah is Megillas Esther. It could have been Megillas HaYehudim B'Shushan, it could have been Megillas Mordechai V'Esther, it could have been Megillas Achashverosh V'Haman U'Nefilasam, it could have been a whole host of titles that might have led on as to what the subject matter of the Megillah is. And yet the choice of words for the title of the Megillah is Megillas Esther. It's all about Esther. And apparently, the point of the title, Megillas Esther, the point of this phrase, Kavuni L'Doros, is meant to teach us that the Megillah is not just a story of national salvation, of an existential threat that faced the Jewish nation that they were miraculously delivered from. That certainly is what it is about, but not just that. Rather, the Megillah is also a personal story, story of Esther herself. And the question then becomes, what is that message, what is that story meant to teach us with regard to Esther personally? That's the theme that we will attempt to answer. This is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's insight into the story of the Megillah, which we will come back to. But there's another question as well that I'd like to open up with, and that is the following. A question that is posed by a number of the Mefarshim, which is, the story of the Megillah could have presumably started very easily from the second chapter, Perek Beis. Achashverosh is looking for a queen, gets Esther, she becomes the queen, and so on and so forth. Why is it so critical for us to have the first perek? The perek that tells us about Vashti's downfall, her execution. What role does that play in the story of the Megillah? Why is that so critical? I could have gotten what I need to get as far as understanding the Nes from the point of Perek Bey's beginning, with Esther coming to the palace. What is so critical and crucial about the contribution of Perek Aleph to the story of the Megillah? And this is a theme that the Malbim touches upon in his Perush to the Megillah. And I'd like to start with the Malbim's comments to a number of psukim in the first perek, because they provide us with a beautiful framework to understand the groundwork for the plot that unfolds throughout the Megillah. And we'll be able to then see how that connects to other issues in the Megillah as well. So if you happen to have a Megillas Esther in the back of the Chumashim, if there are some available, It might be helpful to see some of the psukim inside. The Malbim is well known in his commentary on Tanakh as being very, very particular about explaining each and every word. There's no such thing as synonyms in Tanakh according to the Malbim's approach to Tanakh. Every word is unique, every word is important, and he approaches the Megillah in that very same way. And we'll look at a number of psukim in the first parak and see how he understands them, and that will give us a beautiful insight into what really is going on here in Achashverosh's mind in the first parak, which then provides us with the setting for the future parakim in the Megillah. The very first pasuk in the Megillah, Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, it was in the days of Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh hamolech mehodu v'ad Kush. He was the Achashverosh who ruled from Hodu to Kush. And the Malbim questions, it was in the time of Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh who ruled. That seems repetitive right off the start. What is the pasuk getting at? Just tell me. It was in the days of Achashverosh who ruled. Why in the days of Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh who ruled? And the Malbim suggests the following, and this is the basis for his entire understanding of the first parak. He says, when you imagine a monarch, a king, a ruler, you have some kings who possess absolute power. They are completely in control. They are beholden to no one, not to their people, not to any other member of the government. It is all theirs. That's one model of monarchy, of royalty. And then you have a king who is perhaps elected to office by his subjects, who has to deal with the parliament and with opposing political parties. It's not so simple in such a monarchy. He's not the only man in control. He owes his power to others and has to deal with their hold on the power as well. And the Malbim says, we know from the Gemara, we know from Chazal, who was Achashverosh? Achashverosh was an individual who married Vashti, Vashti being the descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. Achashverosh himself apparently did not come from royal blood, according to the understanding of Chazal, and his claim to kingship was because of his wife, Vashti. And the Malbim says, if we look at the very first pasuk, Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, it was in the times of Achashverosh. Not HaMelech Achashverosh, but Achashverosh. Meaning, he was himself a simple guy, an ordinary fellow. However, Hu Achashverosh HaMolech, he was that ordinary fellow who then took control of the empire by virtue of his marriage to Vashti. In the second pasuk, the Malbim says, what do we find? Bayamim Ahem, it was in those days, Kesheves HaMelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Machuso, when the king Achashverosh sat upon his throne, Asher B'Shushan Habira, which was in the capital Shushan. Why is that important? And what is the meaning of that pasuk? So the Malbim suggests, number one, he says, Shushan Habira was never previously the capital. The capital of the empire beforehand was Babel, Babylon. Achashverosh was the one who moved it from Babylon to Shushan, which I think is today Susa in modern-day Iran. Secondly, says the Malbim, Kesheves HaMelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Malchuso, he sat on his throne. Chazal tell us that he made his own throne for himself. He wanted to model it after Shlomo HaMelech's throne. He designed his own elegant, luxurious seat of royalty. The purpose of this pasuk being, says the Malbim, to tell us that Achashverosh was trying to make a name for himself as an independent, all-in-control king. He's not in the throne because the king before him sat in the throne, or because his wife's grandfather was ruling in Babylon. He's going to make an independent name for himself. He's going to make his own throne. He's going to move to the capital from Babel, from Babylon, to Shushan. Shushan Habir, this is all him. He is independent. He's not a king because of what preceded him. He's a king in his own right. What does he do? He throws a tremendous party. What is the purpose of the party, says the Malbim? In Pasuk Dalid, Bihar Oso es Osher Kavod Malchuso. He's trying to show off the wealth of his kingship. He's showing off the money of the kingdom, not as the people's possessions, but as his own. Which is all my wealth. And ultimately, the the ultimate goal of this party, the ultimate purpose of this party, was to bring Vashti in before him. And when we read the Pesukim with regard to Vashti, so first we find in Pasuk Tes that Vashti Hamalka also made a party for the women in the base Hamalkus that belonged to Achashverosh, in the palace that belonged to Achashverosh. Notice, says the Malbim, that whereas Achashverosh's party was for the Sarim and the Chael Parasim Madai and the Partimim and the Sarim Hamedinos, Achashverosh invited all the officers and all the commanding soldiers of the army. Vashti's party was just for the women. Achashverosh didn't want to let her have that claim to the throne of having all the dignitaries at her party. And what happens, as we know in Pasuk Yud, we're told that on the seventh day when the king was good and drunk, he told seven of his aides, of his assistants, L'havias Vashti ha'maka l'fnei ha'melech b'cheser malchus, to bring in Vashti, the queen, before the king with the crown, L'haros ha'amin v'hasrim es yafya k'tov asmarahi, to show everyone her beauty because she was very beautiful. So the simple understanding of what was going on here is that while Achashverosh was drunk, he and his friends were drunk, and as the Gemara says, what do such people do when they're drunk? They talk about who's prettier, my wife or yours. The Malbim, though, suggests something very insightful and says perhaps there was much more to it. Perhaps the purpose here was to show the people in the kingdom that the reason why I married Vashti was not because she's my key to the kingship. It's only through her I get the king's throne. But rather, he's trying to show that she's the prettiest woman around, and that's why I married her. He's bringing her in to show everyone how beautiful she is, because he's trying to show everyone, I'm king in my own right, independent of anybody else. I'm not king because of my wife. I married her because of her beauty. That's why I married her. But the kingship, that's me, because I'm king independently. And notice, says the Malbim, something very fascinating. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, when Achashverosh requests, or orders, I should say, Vashti to come before him, the Pasuk says, L'havi es Vashti ha-malka l'fnei ha-melech, to bring Vashti the queen before the king. And in Pasuk Yud Beis, where she refuses, the Pasuk says, V'timo'ein ha-malka Vashti. It doesn't say Vashti ha-malka, it says ha-malka Vashti. Now when I read this, I just ran through it. Okay, Vashti ha-malka, malka Vashti. It's Purim, you know, things change. Not so worried about the change in syntax. Yet the Malbim says, no, stop a second. There's a big difference, he says. Achashverosh ordered to bring Vashti HaMalka before him because in his mind she's Vashti first. Malka comes second because she's married to me. Pasuk Yud Beis, she refuses. V'timo'ein HaMalka Vashti. Malka comes first in her mind. I'm the queen first. Vashti second. You're lucky to be married to me. And if you look at the Gemara, source number 4 on the handout sheet, the Gemara says, "Vayitzof haMelech Ma'od." The king was furious. And my dalka bekulei high. Why was he so angry? So the king was furious. Says the Gemara, "Amar Rava." Rava says, source number 4, "Shalchale," because she said to him, "Bar aharire de Abba, you're nothing but a stable boy for my father, the Babylonian king." My father could hold wine in front of thousands of people and not get drunk by it. And you drink a little wine and already you're dead drunk. So what did Vashti say to him? You're nothing but a stable boy. I'm the queen here. You're the stable boy who happened to marry me. Don't forget. And as a result, Pasuk Yud Beis, we're told, Vayitzof haMelech Ma'od, he's very angry. V'chamaso bo'aravo, his anger burned within him. Once again, seeming repetition. Very angry, his anger burned within him, says the Malbim. It's not a repetition, needless repetition. It's an important repetition. The Malbim says there's a difference between Vayitzof and Chamaso. Paro katsaf al avadav. Paro got angry at his servants. We read in Parshas Miketz. Katsaf, Vayitzof, says the Malbim, is an outward anger, an expressed anger. He was outwardly angry because she refused him in public. She disobeyed him in public. The Chamaso Baravo, Chema, that burns within him, was that anger he could not express. What could he not express? He could not express how insulted he was that, number one, she had accused him or proved him to be just a stable boy. But number two, his whole design was thwarted. His whole plot to plan this party was all about proving that I'm the one in charge independently. She just happens to be married to me. He wants to bring her to him to show that you're Vashti first and Malka second. And she turned it all on its head and said, no, no, Hamalka Vashti, I'm the queen. You married me. Chamaso baravo. That he can't express to others. That's an embarrassment. He can't tell to other people what he was thinking and what happened. That he has to keep within him. That anger burned inside him because not only was he publicly humiliated, but what he was trying to accomplish, he was trying to prove that he was the supreme commander here and she was the vice president or whatever the case might be. And she said, no, no, no. I'm the one in charge. You married me. Hence, Vayiktsof and Chamaso Barava. And what happens as a result then is very fascinating. When Haman speaks to Achashverosh in Pasuk Tes Zayin, called Mimuchan, he speaks of Vashti as Vashti Hamalka. He knows to be careful how he speaks about the king's wife to the king. He knows that to Achashverosh she's Vashti Hamalka. And yet in Pasuk Tes Vav, when Achashverosh asked them what to do with the Malka Vashti, what do we do with her? She is showing herself to be the Malka Vashti, to be in charge. We've got to do something about this. You see very clearly the tension that was really underlying the story here. What was really behind the scenes happening. And so now, with this in mind, take this opening parak theme and look ahead to the Megillah. So Vashti is executed. She's out of the way. So now Meir Goldwicht suggests, what do you think Achashverosh is going to be looking for in his next queen? Or what will his committee, the search committee, be looking for in the next queen? They're going to be looking for the most nondescript, simplest, quietest, unassuming person there can be. Because we don't want the king to have any more trouble as he had with Vashti. Now, of course, we know that Hashgacha Pratis had that Esther would be chosen as the queen. But Al Derech HaPshat, perhaps if you take a simple understanding of what the story is all about, why might that have appealed to Achashverosh and his committee members when they're looking for a queen? So Meir Goldwicht suggests, imagine, he says, you have everyone's resume submitted to the king, and everyone's going to put on their resume, I am the granddaughter of the second cousin of the second to last king's wife who ruled here 25 years ago. Other one's going to say, well, I have connections to this politician, to that politician, I'm related to this family of nobility, etc., etc., etc. Everyone's going to be putting in their best claim for the queen position. Comes Esther, and what does Esther say? Esther Bas Avichayil. We don't know anything about her background. She doesn't tell you where she's from. She doesn't tell you where her family is. We don't know anything about her. Nothing about her. We know she's from Shushan. We know her name is Esther Bas Avichayil. And that's it. So Achashverosh says, aha, perfect. Just what I need. Someone who is not going to have any dreams of taking my power. This is who I want to be the queen. Most unassuming person I can think of. And if we flip ahead for a moment to Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Zayin, the Pasuk stresses to us how Vayehav HaMelech es Esther mikol hanoshim, the king loved Esther from all the women, Vayosem Keser Malchus Perosho Vayam Licheha Tachas Vashti. He put the crown on her head, he put her in place of Vashti. It's all him in control, him deciding, him doing. Now this also perhaps gives us some insight into another interesting question in the Megillah. And that is, why in fact did Esther not tell anybody where she was from? Or why did Mordechai tell Esther not to tell anybody where she was from? Maybe, perhaps, this is why Achashverosh liked her, because she had no claims to yichus, to greatness. But from Esther's perspective, from Mordechai's perspective, why did she not tell anybody where she was from? Why was she instructed not to say anything about her family? And there's a very fascinating discussion in the Rishonim, Rashi and the Ben Ezra, on the source sheet here, as to why that might have been the case. So the Ibn Ezra says in source number 5 on the source sheet, some say, he writes, "Ki Mordechai lo asa nechona," that Mordechai acted inappropriately by telling Esther not to tell who she was from. Why? "Ki pachad shelo yikachena hamelech leisha im yeda shehi mehagola." Ibn Ezra says, perhaps Mordechai's reasoning was he was afraid that if the king would know that she is a Jewish exile from Israel, he would not want her to be the queen. He would not want her for that reason. And Mordechai, apparently, according to this explanation, wanted her to become queen. Which is not the impression you get from reading the Psukim. Esther was taken against her will, apparently. Yet Ibn Ezra says that some suggest that Mordechai, in fact, wanted her to be queen and told her not to say who she's from, because maybe then he would not take her as queen. "Oh, she's a Jewish exile, Jewish slaves, I don't want her, I'm not interested." Others say, says the Ibn Ezra, that no, Mordechai did want her to be queen, and he knew that the way she would get in would be by concealing her identity, and he knew that she was being put in the right position at the right time to help the Jewish nation somehow in the future. And the Ben Ezra himself says, well, maybe he did it because he wanted her to have an easier time of keeping kosher in the palace, keeping mitzvot in the palace. It's better if they don't know who she is. But perhaps the pshat we're more familiar with, and most familiar with, is that of Rashi. Rashi says that the reason why Mordechai told Esther not to tell anybody who she was from, Rashi, source number 6, tells us in the source sheet, because if they would know that she was from the Shaul HaMelech's family, descended from Jewish royalty, what would happen? He would take her. And Mordechai did not want her to become queen. Unlike the Ibn Ezra says, he wanted her to become queen, he's trying to figure out how to get her in. Rashi says, no. Mordechai said, I don't want him to know that you're royalty, because if he knows you're from Shaul HaMelech, he will take you, and I don't want that. Now, according to Rashi's pshat, it's very ironic. Mordechai is telling Esther, don't tell him you're from Shaul HaMelech, because if he knows your royalty, he will take you, and I don't want that. According to the Malbim's understanding of the first parak, what is Achashverosh specifically looking for? The last thing he wants is a Jewish princess. That's the last thing on his mind. Someone who has no claims to royalty is exactly what he wants. And it would seem then that everything worked against what Mordechai had been trying to accomplish, according to this understanding of the Malbim. Ironic, but again, the Yad Hashem and the Megillah working things out as it should be worked out. Now, I think this theme also is a perfect lead-in to understanding the personal story of Esther, which I mentioned earlier as being one of the key lessons of the Megillah. Because so far we have seen that Esther was chosen by Achashverosh because he wanted someone unassuming, someone who would lack the initiative to take power for herself. That's what he was looking for. And the truth is, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein suggests that if we look at other psukim in the Megillah, this seems to be exactly the way Esther is portrayed. He says, for example, if we look at what we are told about Esther in the beginning of the Megillah, Perek Beis. Perek Beis, Pasuk, Zion. We are told that Mordechai cared for Esther because she had no parents. She was very beautiful when her parents died. Mordechai took her levas, either as a daughter or as a wife, according to Chazal. We are told in Perek Beis Pasuk Yud that Esther did not tell anybody who her people were. Why? Ki Mordechai tziva aleha ashalos agid. Mordechai said, don't tell anybody. And that's repeated again. Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf. Again, ein Esther magedes moladeta ve'esama. Esther has not told anybody her birthplace, her people. Kasher tziva aleha Mordechai, as Mordechai commanded her. Ve'esma'amar Mordechai Esther osa, and whatever Mordechai said, Esther did. Kasha ha'isa ba'amna yita, as it was when he was caring for her. What is the sense you get of Esther from these psukim? Twice we're told she doesn't say where she's from, because Mordechai told her not to say anything. Mordechai commanded her not to do it. Whatever Mordechai says, she does. Mordechai cared for her because she had no parents. Mordechai brought her up and raised her. What kind of sense does that seem to be portraying Esther as, according to the Sibur in the Pesukim? We don't see any activity on her part, any initiative in regard to anything. It's very passive, obedient. Mordechai cared for her. Whatever Mordechai says, she does. Twice we're told that. The whole introduction we're given to Esther in this parak is all about Esther being very passive and cared for by Mordechai. And even after she's taken to the palace as the queen, again, Mordechai is still telling her what to do. He's standing by the palace gate, listening to news about Esther, guiding her. When she was taken to the king for the first time, Parak Beis Pasuk Tesvav, Ubahagia Tor Esther Bas Avichal, when Esther's turn came to go to the king, Lo Viksha Davar, she didn't ask for anything. Whatever Haggai, the man in charge of the women, told her to do, she did it. By other women who were going to the king, it says, whatever they wanted, they got. Everyone else, whatever they said, give me this, give me that, they got it. With Esther, she didn't ask for anything. Whatever he told her to do, she did. That was it. So repeatedly in Parak Beis, when we're introduced to Esther in the Megillah, we're given the sense of she just does what she's told. Not independence, but dependence. And that, again, precisely what Achashverosh is looking for. And yet, as we know, you look later on in the Megillah, and, for example, turn to the end of the Megillah in Perek Tes. Before I do that, let me just make one mention of a famous Gemara Maseches Chulin on the source sheet. The Gemara Maseches Chulin Daf Kufla Metesim and Beis says Esther min haTorah minayin. Where do we find an allusion to Esther in the Torah? And the Gemara in Chulin quotes the pasuk, "V'anochi haster astir." I will conceal myself. Haster astir. I will conceal myself. So you read this Gemara, you think, okay, haster astir. Esther sounds similar, same root of the word. But perhaps Rav Aaron Lichtenstein suggests the message in that Gemara is that Esther, as a personality, as a character in the story at this point in Parak Beis, is very hidden, very subdued. And yet, we turn to Parak Tes, and what do we find in Parak Tes? In Parak Tes, we find in Pasuk Chaf Tes, for example, Parak Tes, Pasuk Chaf Tes, we find Vatichtov Esther Hamalka Bas Avichayil Mordechai HaYehudi Eskol Tokef. Who wrote down the events of Purim? First Esther, and then Mordechai. And even the verb that's used, Vatichtov, doesn't say Vayichtavu, Vatichtov, she took the leading role. The Gemara we saw earlier in Megillah, she said to the Chacham, "Kavuni l'doros, I'm the one who wants the Purim holiday to be established for all generations to come." In Parak Tes Pasuk Yud Gimel, after the first day of battles between the Jews and their enemies, when the Jews were incredibly successful in killing hundreds of enemies, Pasuk Yud Gimel tells us about Tomer Esther Imal HaMelech Tovi Nosin Gam Mochar LaYehudim Asher B'Shushan. She says to the king, give us another day to fight some more. All of a sudden, this very unassuming individual is very confident, very courageous, taking initiative, asking for another day of battle, telling the Chacham to establish me as a holiday for all generations to come. And certainly the entire manner through which Esther engineered Haman's downfall wasn't just courageous, it was brilliant, it was cunning. She goes to Achashverosh, she invites him to a party with Haman, immediately arousing his jealousy, just me and Haman, who is this Haman? And then she invites him to another party with just her and Haman, Achashverosh, again, putting Achashverosh and his paranoia self more on edge. Who is this Haman that is coming to a personal party with me and my queen? And the entire manner through which she engineers Haman's ultimate execution by setting him up for the downfall is brilliant. And so how did this change in character come about? The Esther started out just doing what she was told, morphed into this courageous, independent fighter on behalf of her people. And the key turning point, Rabbi Lichtenstein suggests, is the in Perek Dalet, in the middle of the Megillah. In the middle of the Megillah, Perek Dalet, what happens there? The decree has just been issued against the Jewish people. Mordechai hears about it, tears his clothing, puts on sackcloth and ashes, cries in the streets. And in Pasuk Dalet, we're told that the maidservants of Esther come to her, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Dalet. They tell her what happened. Batischalchal hamalka me'od. She trembles. She immediately reacts. And it's interesting, this is the first time in the Megillah that there's a verb used with regard to Esther aside from Vatomer Esther l'melech b'shem Mordechai. Till this point, the only thing Esther has done is told the king what Mordechai told her to tell him about Bigston and Sarah. So this is the first time that we find Esther actually doing something. And what does she do? She trembles. And how does she react? Vatishlach begadim l'halbish es Mordechai. She sends Mordechai a set of clothing to change into. Meaning what? Something has shaken her. She's obviously distressed. But how does she react? Her first concern is her adoptive father or husband, Mordechai. Give him a change of clothing. And Mordechai refuses. So Esther asks Hasach, find out what's going on. What's this all about? Maybe she hadn't heard at all. Maybe she had heard rumors but hadn't heard confirmation of the details. And Hasach goes to Mordechai. Mordechai tells him to tell Esther everything that happened. Mordechai even gives Hasach a copy of the decree to show Esther. Ulahagidla, to tell her. Ulitzavos aleh, to command her. Lavo el hamelch, to go to the king. Leschananlo, to beg him. Levakish milfanav alama, to beseech him for her people. And what happens? Esther responds, but how does she respond? She tells Mordechai, everyone knows that if you walk into the king's inner room without being called, he'll be killed immediately. And granted, there are some exceptions. If he extends the scepter to you, then you'll live. But I haven't been called into the king for 30 days now. It's a suicide mission for me. I can't go in there. So Esther at this point, although clearly expressing concern and care for Mordechai by giving him a change of clothing, but she's resisting the call from Mordechai to act on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And Mordechai's response is shocking. What does he say? In Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Gimel, he says, "Al tedami bin nafsheich lihimaleit beis hamelach mikol ha'yehudim." Don't think that you will be able to escape safely to the king's palace as opposed to all the other Jews. Because if you're silent now, the Jews will be saved some other way, but you will be destroyed. And maybe this is why you have been put in this position of royalty. I read the pasuk every year. It's familiar to us. But what was Mordechai really saying to her? Don't you dare think that you will be able to escape while everyone else will die. Essentially, almost accusing her of thinking, I'll be okay, that's all I need, and everyone else, whatever happens, happens. Is that what he's doing? He's accusing Esther of actually consciously thinking that as long as I'm safe and taken care of, that's all I need to know? That's such a harsh response. What was he really saying to her? It's a very troubling question if you think about it. I mean, Mordechai should have criticized her lack of initiative, her lack of confidence, should have criticized maybe her lack of independence, her lack of courage, but to accuse her of thinking that I'm going to escape while everyone else is killed, that's pretty severe. So one explanation, which I saw Rav Yitzchak Kuttner writes in his Pachad Yitzchak, was, well, maybe what Mordechai was telling her was the following. He was telling her, we all know that when you daven for something, for somebody else, someone else needs something and you daven on their behalf, your tefillah is much more passionate if you need that same thing as well. If you have that same need as somebody else and you daven on their behalf, your tefillah is much more passionate because you share that need. And a passionate tefillah is much more powerful and moving and impactful. So perhaps what Mordechai was saying to Esther was, go to the king and beg him, but don't beg him thinking that you're okay regardless and it's just the Jews you're asking for, the other Jews. Beg him as if you're begging for yourself, because then it'll come across as passionate, as powerful, as moving. Okay, that's perhaps one understanding of what Mordechai was saying to Esther. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, though, suggests additional possibility. And that is perhaps what Mordechai was saying to Esther is the following. He's saying to Esther, granted, perhaps until now you've been very unassuming, dependent on others. But if at this point in time, when there is a danger to Klal Yisrael, and you have the opportunity to act, and you don't act, what really underlies that inaction, even Mordechai is saying to Esther, is perhaps subconsciously the thought that as long as I'm okay, I don't really have to act that much. Your inaction at this time, he's hinting to her, really might stem from apathy if you're not going to act powerfully. Esther, of course, didn't think this way, but what Mordechai is perhaps suggesting to her is when your people are in mortal danger and you have the possibility of doing something for them and you choose not to, certain sense, it's almost as if you're thinking only of yourself, not of everyone else. Because otherwise, how could you not act? So of course Esther wasn't thinking that, but he's telling her, what is the root of the inaction, should you choose to take the inaction route? It's almost a sense of apathy. You have to, he says, react, because you feel the danger to you as you feel to every other Jew. This, says Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, is the lesson of the story of Esther on a personal level. We speak of Megillas Esther as a lesson and as a contemporary message for all generations. He says, what is the lesson? The lesson is that you had a young woman who, as the Megillah introduces her, starts out as very dependent, very unassuming, perhaps quiet to herself, not looking for power, not looking for to make any waves. But if she finds herself in a position where she can do something to help Klal Yisrael who are in danger, she had to struggle with that moment of decision to realize that I need to act, I need to overcome whatever hesitation I might have naturally ingrained into me to act on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And once she had that will, that desire, that decision was made to do what she could, all of a sudden, all those latent talents that she had inside her, the brilliant ingenuity that went into the planning of the downfall of Haman, her courageous life-risking venture into Achashverosh's room, her independence and her drive to eradicate all vestiges of Amalek in Shushan and elsewhere, and to make it a permanent story for all generations to come, that all came forth, that all flowered. Once she made the decision, that conscious decision to act on behalf of Klal Yisrael, she wanted to do it, then the personality followed through as well. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein adds, he says, that at a certain level, every Jew at a certain point in life is an Esther. Megillas Esther is read every year, and one of the lessons we should be taking from it is that each and every one of us, at one point or another, is an Esther. We have some natural hesitations, fears, lack of desire to get involved where we don't have to. But at a certain time, there comes a point when perhaps we should ask ourselves, "Umi yodea im la'es kazos higat l'malchus." Maybe you're in a certain position at a certain time because you're supposed to be acting. And the Ralbag, I noticed, actually comments in his Perush on Megillas Esther, Ralbag throughout Tanakh always lists the to'elus, the point of the story of Tanakh. And here in this story, he says, the point of the story is that often a person is granted by Kadosh Baruch Hu a certain talent, certain strength. And at a certain time, when that strength or talent can be put to use, he says, we have to be ready and willing to jump to the opportunity to rise to the challenge. And I thought how unfortunately relevant that is today as well. I'm sure everyone here saw the same gruesome graphic images that I saw last week following the cold-blooded massacre. So many young boys in yeshiva. Just reading about Yehonatan Eldar, 16 years old, buried with his Gemara because it was soaked in his blood when he was murdered while learning the Daf Yomi. And the question that tugs at everyone is, what am I supposed to do? And sometimes the easiest approach is to say, well, I can't do anything. I'm here, that's there. And that's all there is to it. And Mordechai tells us, God forbid. He says, the time when Klai Yisrael is faced with mortal danger, he tells Hasach to tell Esther, Lavo el Hamelech, v'eschanin lo. Go to the king. Beg him. Levakesh mulfanav al'ama, to ask him for mercy for her people, for your people. The Vilna Gaon writes in his Perush on Megillas Esther that whenever the Megillah uses the word Hamelach without the name Achashverosh, it refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lavo el Hamelach leheschanin lo. The first course of action is to go to the Melech. Go to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and beg him. Secondly, Al Amma, for her people, for our people, to feel that connection. To feel that it's our brothers and our sisters who are in mortal danger. And not to ever even subconsciously think, Al Tadami Benaf Sheikh Lihmalait Beis Hamelch Mikolai Yehudim, to think that we are safe and sound here, so it's not a concern of ours. Sfas Emes, in his comments in Purim, writes so beautifully. He says, why is it that Purim, out of all the holidays of the Jewish calendar, is the one holiday where there's a mitzvah of matonas lev yonim, of mishloach manos? And he says, because when you're fighting against an Amalek, a people that wants nothing more than to destroy the Jewish people, when you're fighting against an enemy that values your death more than their life, and your death more than their children, and more than their future, he says, the only way to overcome such an enemy is through achdus. Is through showing brotherly love from one Jew to another. Hence, matanos levyonim, mishloach manos, to reach out to other Jewish people, to show that there is this brotherly bond between us, to feel that amma, that's our people, and it's time to come out, even if until now we have been in the Esther mode of not saying or identifying with the people, now's the time to make it clear that we identify with our people. Sfas Emes writes, that's why in the response, Nikalu v'amod al nafsham, they gathered together and they stood al nafsham for their life. It doesn't say they fought al nafsho sehem for their lives. Al nafsham, they fought for their life. Because all Jews are interconnected. Not just because we stem from a common ancestor physically, but on a spiritual level as well. That one nefesh, neshama, that we all stem from. We all have a piece of everyone else in us. And we have to not just feel it, but express it, especially on Purim, and especially at a time when we confront an Amalek that wants nothing more than to kill Jews. That's just to read to you from Rav Moshe Cordovero's Tomer Devorah. How is this Achdus supposed to be expressed? How does one express this sense of feeling connected to the rest of Am Yisrael? He writes, Kol Yisrael heim she'er basar elum elu. Every Jew is related to another. Not just physically, but mitnei shehaneshamos kalulos yachad. We're bound together, spiritually speaking. Yesh bazeh chelek zeh ubazeh chelek zeh. Everyone's neshama has a bit of someone else's neshama in them. And he says, therefore, practically speaking, he writes, "V'lekach, therefore, ro'oi la'adam lios chafetz b'tovaso shel chavero. Person should be happy with his friend's success. V'kvoda yechaviv alav kishalo. Person should treasure someone else's honor and respect as he treasures his own. Sharei hu mamish, because we're one and the same." He says, so too, lo yirtze b'gnus chaver, a person shouldn't look to denigrate somebody else And when someone else is suffering, he writes, "V'yaralo mimenuk iluhum mamish hayishor ba'osatzar," to feel that we are also suffering that same pain. I think that message of Esther is certainly not just appropriate every year, so much more so this year, considering the malach that we are facing, that we are confronting. The response must be, number one, first and foremost, levo al hamelach lehischanen lo, levakesh mulfano al amma, approach the melach, beg him, ask him, but also al amma, to realize it's our people, to identify with our people, to feel for our people. Thank you very much.